Okay, this is Monday, November 19, 2007, and John Colley and I are going to interview Tom Watkins primarily about the Northfield Psychiatric Hospital for identification. John, say something, pick up your voice.
Oh, okay, this is a test for the voice. Okay.
And this is Tom Watkins. I hope you can remember.
Right. She remembers it. Anyhow, you're the head of the organization for a while, so I guess, I don't know, tell us what time frame you were involved and what went on there, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, well, my history with North Hill Regional Psychiatric Hospital probably goes back into the early 70s. I did my graduate work in social work administration at Wayne State University and ran a number of community mental health agencies. In 82, Governor Blanchard got elected. I was his deputy campaign manager.
Just a little bit slower, or I will catch the devil.
Your husband's looking out for you. I think it was 1982. I was Governor Blanchard's deputy campaign manager when he first ran for governor. Joined the governor after he was successful in that race as deputy chief of staff for the governor's office. Spent about probably almost a year in the governor's office as deputy chief of staff to the governor. And in 83, late 82, I moved over and joined somebody who I considered my mentor and somebody I consider that today, C. Patrick Babcock, who was the director under Governor Milliken. In fact, they changed the law so that Pat Babcock could become the director of the Department of Mental Health. Prior to his appointment, you had to be an MD, a psychiatrist, at least an MD, if not a psychiatrist, in order to do that. So I came over in 1983 as the deputy director, as the Department of Mental Health, as the deputy director of administration, had all the administrative responsibilities for about $1.3 billion budget, Northfield Regional Psychiatric Hospital being one. In 1986, Pat Babcock left. Probably 84, 85, I became the chief deputy, which had the clinical responsibility as well as the administrative. And in 1986, when Pat Babcock moved over to run the then Department of Social Services, today I think they call it the Department of Human Services or something, but he moved over to that department and Governor Blanchard appointed me on an acting basis and then permanent a few months after that as the director, which I served as the director of the Michigan Department of Mental Health from 86 till 90. And a funny thing happened in the election in 1990. Governor Engler took over.
And under your responsibility, you had how many hospitals were under your jurisdiction?
That's a good question. At that time, I think it was in the low 20s, probably about half that number, a little more than half psychiatric hospitals, some children's hospital like Hawthorne Center, Yorkwood, a couple of other psychiatric hospitals for children, and the rest were referred to as centers for the developmentally disabled. The one out here at Plymouth Center at 5 and Sheldon was one of those centers. Ultimately, they were closed. In fact, there's only one center for the developmentally disabled open, and I'm not sure how many psychiatric hospitals there are left.
No, there's not many.
Not many, no.
But what were the big changes that happened while you were there?
Oh boy, there was a lot of changes that went on. Probably the biggest change that took place about that time is the change in the medication to treat people that are mentally ill. The psychotropic medication, there was a tremendous amount of research going on in drug companies. And before that, I'm trying to remember, they called it the Thorazine Shuffle, with people that would be given that medication and it would do things to kind of make you, and a lot of people would describe it in a zombie state. There were a number of new medications that came online at that time, as well as the push, probably begun during the Nixon-Kennedy years, and following a big push towards community-based care. But at that time, Northville had approximately, I think at the heyday, maybe 1,500 people that were mentally ill that lived at Northville, including the young adult center.
Well, when I was on the township board, there was always a big to-do about the walkaways.
Yeah, it always was. I remember spending my birthday, November 12th, with Senator Geek, who was also, his wife was our veterinarian, but spending time with Bob Geek at a community setting over at the neighborhood. It was at the Northville City Hall, with a lot of angry residents from the subdivisions, primarily directly behind that hospital. The one that I do remember during that time is, you know, as I sat there, and obviously I had a deep amount of respect for Bob Geig, Senator, still do. And, you know, he asked me to come down. He, beyond the personal respect and professional respect for I had, he also was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee for my department, so I wasn't any fool. He asked me to come to a meeting, birthday or not. I did. And I remember sitting there and being polite and listening to the people and the concerns they have, because obviously, as residents, you know, my community, I lived here at that time, commuted to Lansing, never moved to Lansing. You know, I had the concern, and I have family, and I understand those concerns. But I remember one, you know, it was getting late, I wanted to go home, celebrate my birthday, and, you know, finally, I said, you know, come on, guys, you know, you built your house in the shadows of a 6-7-story building, you know, the largest psychiatric hospital in the world, in our world, or large in the state. You didn't expect that there would be some issues, you know, that you maybe you had a better price on your property. And I'll never forget that one woman said, well, I was told that was a state police post. And at that point, I think I slapped my head and said, you know, if we need a 7-story state police post here in Northville, then we got more problems than walkaways from the psychiatric hospital.
Well, what level of mental health were you dealing with or here? I know there's a lot, some that are a lot more debilitating than others.
Well, at the psychiatric hospital, in order to get in to the psychiatric hospital at the time, we had in fact, one of the things that I can't remember if it changed when I was deputy and worked for PAPDAP, Cocker, I changed it, but we had an admissions office at the hospital grounds. Well, any police officer, any social worker or the like that had a problem with a person in the community would bring them out to the hospital. Well, guess what happens at an admissions office? You get admitted. So, you know, and once somebody would get into the hospital, and it may have been a psychotic episode, you know, with treating medication, a little bit of therapy, you could move them back to a least restrictive environment, least costly. I mean, if I remember the day, it was $200 a night. It was a pretty expensive hotel if you didn't need to be in that hospital. We changed that. The front door were the community-based programs. Had the responsibility on making the determination of whether someone met the criteria for involuntary admission. And that was, are they a danger to themselves and others and unable to take care of their basic needs and suffering from a mental illness? You couldn't deprive somebody of their liberty just because they're a public nuisance. You know, they're urinating in the bushes, they're acting a bit bizarre. They had to meet that criteria for an involuntary admission. Early on, there were people that were voluntarily admitted there. And again, they could be somebody that was having some difficulties in the community. And it would end up being a lockup for local people. But we changed that and really required that the admission be done somewhere outside and making sure they met that legal criteria for admission.
Well, where did the people generally come from? Locally, Wayne County?
It was Wayne County primarily. There's a good portion, I can't remember the statistics, but you know, Wayne County in particular, but Detroit had a larger percentage of that, some of which were lifelong Detroit residents, and some, as you can imagine, if they were mentally ill, psychotic, severely depressed, they would kind of oftentimes get kicked out of their suburban homes. Didn't fit in Northville or Livonia or Wixom or someone else, and they'd end up downtown in Detroit. And so a lot of the residents may have a Detroit residence, but they may have originated from Belleville or Garden City or Westland or Northville, but they tend to, you know, like anybody in that, whether it's homeless, mental illness, mental retardation, they tend to migrate. The other, which took place in the early 60s and 70s, is that the first foray of deinstitutionalization and community-based programs, the only places that those programs were allowed, usually were in a rural setting, you know, out on some farm somewhere, so we may have had some out in this area during that time, or down in the large homes in Grand Boulevard, Cass Quarter, and the like, low-rent district, where people that were not valued by society tended to go. Homeless people, people with alcohol problems, mental retardation, mental health issues. And so you had a lot of those, you know, large stately homes, which were turned into adult foster care homes, which had minimal amount of resources from the state, you know, maybe dollars a day to take care of somebody that with a, you know, and it could range from a moderate, what was referred to as the walking worried, you know, like all of us have issues in our daily lives, to somebody that was actively psychotic, severely depressed,
but
or
you did have professional staff in the home.
Oh, absolutely. Well, no, in some of those homes, basically, you had a good care provider, you know, Aunt Matilda, that took care of, you know, Uncle Charlie, you know, maybe down south a number of years ago, or here. But a lot of those adult foster care homes, for some very, very good people with good hearts, but, you know, maybe high school or less education, that were there. And basically, they were room and board homes. There was not a lot of service that that were offered to those individuals.
So therefore, not much treatment.
Little or no treatment. If the treatment was taking place at 99.9% of the time, certainly wasn't happening in that house, that home. They may have gone out to some outpatient clinic, but in those early days, there was very little that was developed, and the waiting lists were fairly significant for individuals.
Did you... The psychiatric hospital here in Northville started in what, 1952?
I think that it was. It was in the late 50s, mid 50s.
It operated here for about 50 years.
Right.
Yeah. Now, when they closed it, you were long gone.
Yeah, I was gone. I left in 1990.
What were your feelings on that?
Well, my feeling is you know, there's, if you take a look at buildings in the history of what we've done, particularly in mental health. In criminal justice, both are areas that I've worked in. If you build a building, society will find reasons to stick people in those buildings long after the technology, the programs, the services have changed in order to meet those needs. I believe clearly that my level of care of what I would associate with is that if somebody in my family, my mother, my father, my sister, my brother, aunt, uncle that was mentally ill, would I want them there? Now, I don't care. They have JCH accreditation. Like, my level of accreditation would be that level. You know, if my dad was sick, would I think that was a good place to go? Community-based programs are always better, in my view, if we have the right services and care. There was a need. Some of our long-term psychiatric hospitals became used as warehouses. You know, out of sight, out of mind, very expensive care. I mean, and I may be off on it, but the number $400 a day and up comes to mind of what it was costing. I believe that hospital at one time had a budget in excess of $60 million. Over 1,000 plus staff that went there, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Very, very expensive to run. And if somebody needs that level of care, then that made sense. But if you think about it, boy, you can get a whole lot of service. And you have to begin to ask yourself, are we servicing the buildings, or are we providing services to the individual? Oftentimes, in public policy, and I've been involved in government and nonprofits and business a long time, but the pendulum tends to swing from one side to the other. I mean, we're watching that right now in the corrections debate. You know, we got more people locked up in prisons in the state of Michigan than the surrounding states do. Now, some people, again, have the mentality, lock them up, throw away the key. But somebody's got to pay for that. You know, as you know, it costs more to care for someone in a state prison than it does to send your child to some of the finest universities in this country. Now, for the really bad people, dangerous people, fine, let's lock them up, throw away the key, kind of speak. But some of that, I think, was beginning to happen at Northville. We had to ask ourselves, again, under the law, is a person a danger to themselves or others, unable to take care of their basic needs, and have a mental illness? And if they did, then it made an involuntary, but it should be as short a term as you possibly could, and then back out. Now, what would happen is oftentimes back out, meant back to the street, the person stopped taking their medication, and may as well put them on a conveyor belt, because, you know, sooner or later they were going to, as I used to say, and I don't like to use this vernacular, but once in a while, you know, sooner or later, somebody who's got a mental illness is going to do something crazy. I mean, that's the nature of the illness, and it's going to land them here. What's happened, though, to, I think, the detriment of the individual and the detriment to the society and a high cost is that too many of our local jails and prisons have replaced the state hospitals that used to have people that are mentally ill. I think if you talk to most sheriffs, police officers, and corrections officers, they'll say a lot of people that used to be at Ipsy State Hospital, Clinton Valley Center, and Northville Regional Psychiatric Hospital, you know, they're not in a community-based program. They're in a community lockup or a state prison and not getting the level of care that they need for their illness.
What was the routine when you had patients there that were there for a long time? You must have had some programs to educate them, to exercise them?
There was a whole array of services, even social worker, occupational therapy, music therapy, art therapy, gymnasiums, getting out on the grounds. But one of the things that was very difficult during those years, if you recall, the waning years of Governor Milliken's tenure, the departments were severely cut because of the recession that Michigan was under. And I used to kiddingly say, if you ever see me go from private business back into the public sector, put your money in your mattress because the economy is going to hell in a handbasket. I've never had the luxury of running a state department when we were in an economic upturn. And I can't imagine what it would have been to, you know, to do that when we actually had resources in the state. You know, here we are again. So there was a number of those programs that were there, but a good part of the years that that Pat Babcock and I were there, we were basically managing downwards. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars that were removed during the latter part of the Milliken administration. Certainly the first number of years of the Blanchard administration. And then when the resources began to come back, we began to hit a recession again in late 80s, early 90s. And so there was literally hundreds of millions of dollars that came out of the Department of Mental Health during that time. And typically those ancillary professional services are the last to be added and the first to go. And so during a lot of the time that I was there, one that I was proud of that we implemented during those years is I used to go to the city-county building and I'd see people that are mentally ill waiting for their hearing. So we'd have to bus at Northville Psychiatric Hospital. They would load up, you know, a busload of people, 30, 40, or maybe two or three buses, take them down to the Detroit Wayne County, now the Coleman A. Young Complex. Whatever it's called, the conference center, convention, whatever it is down there, the old city-county building down in Woodward and Jefferson, where they would sit in the basement in a cinder block room with a bench, maybe. Too many people stuffed in too small of a room, where they would have their hearing for whether they were met the law of danger to themselves or others, as I referred to as others. So they may go there, have their hearing at 9:15, and then sit in that room where people would come by and gawk at the room full of mentally ill folks, and they'd sit there until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. One of the things that we implemented during that time is, rather than taking literally thousands of people during the course of a year, because they'd maybe 1,500 people, but they'd have multiple admissions, they'd have to go through this legal hearing, rather than move thousands of people down to the city-county building, I don't know why, but I thought it was a good idea. Maybe we could just move a judge, a stenographer, and a security person out to hold the hearings at Northville, you know, rather than taking the mountain to Muhammad, bring Muhammad to the mountain. And so we instituted that, and we were able to redirect some money. And if I recall, Senator Geek and Senator Joe Young, not Senator, Representative Joe Young Sr., who was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, for the House, a Democrat from Detroit. They worked to do that. And then we extended the SEMTA line. It used to stop at Livonia Mall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in order to provide public transportations for family, we had that line extended out to the, I think, the hospital. It may even made a turnaround somewhere else here in the city or township before it went back. But that was a way to treat people better, reduce cost at the mm-hmm. hospital.
You had some low-rise outlying buildings. I know you had a theater and a pool and one of them boat. What was that resin? What were they used for?
A lot of those were referred to, some of those were the dormitories or whatever they're called, units. That housed what was referred to as the Young Adult Institute. And these were for kind of that transition phase of someone that may be too old for Hawthorne, and I want to say 17, 18, but not, you know, the 35-year-old hardened person. And there were some program services and certainly psychiatric and social work and psychologists that believe that those individuals were at a different stage of life as opposed to somebody who may be older. So there were a number of those units that were used for that program. Which brings it to full circle to you know, one of the more notorious cases of the Young Adult Center was Dr. Tombo. If you remember that in my memory, but you may want to have somebody research and go on that. But there was a case, and again, this is going by memories that are 20 plus years old. But there was a young man, I think his name was John Bailey, and I can't remember how it all turned out, but he was accused of child molesting out in Brighton, and they tracked it back, and they found out that he was a client at the Young Adult Center at Northville Regional Psychiatric Hospital at the time. And as my memory served me right, Dr. Tombo, who was a psychiatrist at that time, would let him leave, and in fact he was accused, and again, I don't remember, I don't want to besmirch him because I can't remember the facts on it, but he allegedly took him out, took him to Canada, bought this guy drinks and the like. And so the defense, if I recall, from Mr. Bailey was saying a lot of these problems that he had, I think it was a murder charge against him, or murder charges, stem back to that, those incidents with Dr. Tombo, which was pretty heated a period of time, as you can imagine.
I can vaguely remember the name of this, about
it. Yeah, it was Bailey, but it'd be worthwhile for the record to you know, go back and see if you can find on that, because that was a you know, horrendous thing.
You've been Googling.
I think it was John Bailey. I don't know why it's coming to mind, but he was accused out in Brighton of child molestation, if I recall, murder. Or maybe a couple of cases, and then it was tracked back to the Young Adult Center, Dr. Tombo, and what transpired there, and I think I did some of the investigation on that. A guy you may want to even talk to about it, I think he's now at Central Michigan University. He was the administrative assistant to both Pat Babcock and I, and often affectionately referred to as Radar, kind of out of the, you know, MASH. But I mean, he knew everything and kept records on everything. He's at Central Michigan University. His name's Steve Thomas. He may be somebody to talk to.
You recommended talking to Pat Babcock. Where is he located now?
Pat, you may be able to find him through the Kellogg Foundation. He lives in Lansing. And if you email me, I've got his email.
You sent me his email address. I wasn't sure exactly what. Of course, we could always put on a speaker phone and sit there and do it.
Well, not he's down here. His daughter lives and grandson lives down in the Detroit area somewhere, so he's down there. And he definitely would be, because Pat was, I would refer to him for the Milliken years as Mr. Human Services. He started the Office of Service to the Aging. He started the Office of Children and Youth Services. He started the Office of Substance Abuse. He was the labor director, and again, they changed the law for him in order to enable him to become the director after Dr. Frank Ochberg, who was a psychiatrist. And, you know, and again, he was so well thought of, he transitioned from a Republican to a Democrat governor.
Who succeeded you?
Jim Haidman. And Jim is, and again, I have his email as well. He's, I think he's retired. He's doing some work. He did some work over in Iraq for President Bush. But he served in that position. They moved a lot of the departments together after I left in 1990. But he probably was there during the closure. I think it was during his tenure he closed a lot of psychiatric hospitals. He lives in Grand Rapids, and I've got an email for him. And if you want to sit down and talk to him.
You've got a long distance one. If we know he's from a speaker.
Yeah, put him on
a speaker. Swap the tape recorder down.
they'd be able to. But it was Frank Ochberg, who's still, you may be able to find him, he lives in Okemos and Meridian Township, I think, and he's an expert on terrorism, psychiatrist, then Pat Babcock, then Jim Haveman. And again, during that Jim Haveman period, they, I think, collapsed the Department of Health and Human, or Health, and a couple of other departments, and put them into one department. I think Social Services as well, and all of them are all together.
Getting back to our facility here, I had some friends that lived down one of the streets right across from the hospital, Fry Street.
Dirt roads across the street.
And there were, the walkaways were no surprise to them.
Sure.
Their feeling was that all we do is call the hospital to come and get them. They didn't see any threat or anything like that. But they always had the question, and of course I didn't have the answer, and actually didn't care to look for the answer. They said, well, I wonder why they let these people walk away.
Yeah.
So
it's always a difficult one on that, because it's not a jail, you know, and that's one of the things that it was. The other is that if you think about the history of psychiatric hospitals and most, whether it's, you know, the TB Center, which is now the State Park, think about when they were built. I mean, when Northville Regional Psychiatric Hospital was built there, maybe your friends' homes were there, a couple of farmhouses and like, but there wasn't a whole lot out here. And for those individuals, quite honestly, I got a little more sympathy. They'd been there long-standing and the like. When the ones that I became very frustrated with is the ones that built their houses and after. The hospital's there.
It's the same crew that moves next to the pig farm that complains
about
the smell.
Right. You know,
exactly.
and the one that I found pretty interesting on it, but I mean, these are the same neighbors that my sense would, if I was going to categorize them, I would say more conservative, more Republican than Democrat, and yet they wanted the state to build, you know, and I think we ultimately did, for political reasons, build big berms and put in all kinds of landscaping and put in all kinds
of
fences.
Were you there, the infamous rosebush fence?
Exactly.
That never grew?
Never grew. And I bet you...
It never got watered.
But I would guess during that time, there was a million or more dollars spent in order to appease the neighbors. And again, I just found it ironic, because my guess is if you talk to the people philosophically, they would be against government, against taxes, and the like. But when it came to their particular need, if it's a big concern, you built your house there after the hospital, why don't you build the berm? Why don't you put up the fence? Why should all the taxpayers in the state of Michigan provide that to you? And it was like $500,000. And particularly, and it wasn't anti-residents by any stretch of imagination. I mean, it was a frustration with that. But it was more, here's $500,000 that's going to appease somebody that built their house next to the largest state psychiatric hospital. And that means I've got $500,000 left to buy medication for some of the sickest mentally ill people in the state. Less money for social workers, less money for doctors, less money for, you know, better care and services to some of the most vulnerable. I found that pretty annoying, quite honestly, during the time. But the difficulty, when I get back to the walkaways and the like, it's not a jail. And so in order to get the people, you know, as they got better, they were on their meds, they would have freedom on the grounds. And so every once in a while, either through, they wanted to go away and get home, get some mom's cooking, or just wanted, you know, went for a walk and got lost, they would. And you're right, I can't remember what it was, but the vast majority of the walkaways would be more of the incident there. Someone would say, pick up the phone, and, you know, almost some of it was, hey, Charlie's here again. You know, because they would get to know him enough.
This couple that I knew were, you know, very sympathetic.
Yeah, and
they didn't have a problem. And they described, most of the time, they said people just seemed to be confused.
Exactly.
They didn't really know where they were, and didn't know how to get back.
And yet, at the same time, I mean, you know, as a resident, as a family person as well, when they hear that the people that are there because they're mentally ill, they're a danger to themselves or others, and unable to take care of the basic need, when all of a sudden somebody like that comes walking down. And the other aspect of it is, and it's changed a bit today, but I mean, during those days, to see an African-American person walking around in Northville, you figured they were either coming from the prison or from the psychiatric hospital. It was not the norm.
They were an automatic pickup by the police.
Exactly. I mean, it was not. Somebody now.
Yeah.
You know, I saw some of the recent census data. We've got a lot more diversity in this community than we did back in the 70s. But if you were an African American, you were assumed to not be here or walk away from the prison, or if you were running, you were probably from the prison. If you were walking, you were probably from the psychiatric hospital.
You need to go downtown today, know things have changed dramatically.
Yeah.
Very definitely.
Yeah. I mean, just to see, I mean, go up 7 Mile now, seems like I see more African American people there that the hospital's closed than I did during the time in the 70s and 80s during that tenure. Well, and so I think there was a part of that too, which is that, you know, all of a sudden, not only were they mentally ill, they were black. This is a suburban area. It didn't have a lot of black people at that time. Any other questions?
I don't have any.
No, I think you know, it's interesting to see the full cycle, though. The point that I was making about buildings that are there. Again, I remember going to the Menninger Clinic, Carl Menninger, psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that hit me at the time is looking at that is they had lobotomies at the psychiatric museum. They had these cold dunk tanks where they pick people up on some kind of a lift and dump them in ice cold water in order to shock them, electric shock and the like. And what hit me at that time is that none of that was being built to be inhumane. It was perceived to be the best treatment at the time. And, you know, as I said, during that tenure, to see the medications change, to see the treatment regime change, to see additional programs being built in the community, which enabled less and less people to have to be warehoused at a very, very expensive, that wasn't, in my view, good for the taxpayers.
Yeah.
I mean, $400 a day to put somebody up at a hotel because they were homeless and not taking their meds. But what hasn't happened, and it's still not there today, is that promise of adequate treatment for people that are mentally ill. I think the state has done a significantly better job for people that are mentally retarded, developmentally disabled, than they have for children with psychiatric illnesses or adults that have a mental illness.
You know, Dr. Wright's interview indicated he felt that there's an over-reliance on medication for children today. That says some kids just need to be worked with.
Yeah.
And the medication is not really helping that situation.
It's the easiest thing to do.
It's the easiest thing to do, but it isn't resolving the problem.
It's a medical straitjacket.
Yeah.
You know, there was one, I'll never forget, there was one young man, I can remember his name, Garcia. And I was walking through and I saw him there in Northville Psychiatric Hospital. And I'm not sure you want to put this on tape, but he... But he said to me, I'll never forget it, because I said to him, Gracie, what are you doing back here? I know if you take your medication, he was a real big guy. And I said, if you take your medication, you'll be able to do it. He said, I know. But he said, you know, if I take the medication, it messes with my love life. And he said, the choice between having my love life mess with or being crazy, I just assume be crazy. And then he said, you know, somewhat kiddingly too, is the things that you would find out. On day passes, people would go out in the woods and smoke. They'd get people that would bring in marijuana. Some of the staff would sell it to them and do all their kind of things that they shouldn't be doing out there. One that I did when at Northville, I used to, I had keys to every unit. And it was not unusual for me to stop in there at 10 o'clock at night or 2 o'clock in the morning or on Friday or Saturday. And it wasn't, you know, a lot of people thought it was a gotcha for the staff. But some of it was, you know, I believe that unless you have eyes and ears, bad things happen in institutions.
Mm-hmm.
It just becomes the norm. It happened out here at Plymouth Center, if you remember what transpired there, where people with genitalia were being burned and breaks in arms and legs and accusations and, I think, proven sexual assaults. That's when you don't have eyes and ears from the outside coming in. And so we instituted a couple of things. One, I would do it as a way to check and to see and to get to know people. The other is a way to check, because I'd sit up in Lansing and we'd make these policies and procedures. And somehow they had us, you'd always wonder and think, trickled down, and people in the midnight shift or the afternoon shift ever heard. As an example, we had some tragedies during that time when I found out we had a policy that on suicide, the person was on suicide alert, you had to check on them every half hour. Well, I'm not a medical doctor, but I think somebody could, you know, after a while they could figure out that you're going to walk by every once in a while, yeah. And then they figure out it's about every half an hour you walk by, so after you walk by, they hang themselves, yeah. Or do whatever, yeah. They're going to do, and all you do is find a slightly warm body, yeah. You know, as opposed to something. One, we changed that. It was a very costly change, but if we wanted to prevent suicides, and if you really believe somebody is suicidal, you had to have, you know, watches, either a continuous watch or something, you know, where a doctor would say, you know, between this period and this period, they're likely not to be dead. Very, very costly. But it was to go down to see if those kind of policies, yeah. When we passed them up there and through the whole rigmarole, whether anybody on the midnight shift, and, you know, too many times I'd go there and I'd be flipping through the manual, and it'd be 1960 policies. Somehow or another, those new policies never seemed to get into the record at the time. So.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Good luck.
Before you leave, I want to get your picture, though. We always like to do that.
Okay. If I don't know that, I will.